animal is. Thank you very much.
Okay, good afternoon. Thanks. I'll be doing something very, very different. I'll be taking a look at stethoscopes, which is sort of related to what we saw, but I'll be taking a look at literature to do that, which is very different, obviously, from the presentations we just heard. But perhaps these differences and similarities are something we can talk about afterwards. So the title of this presentation is Reading the Animal Pulse, Species and Stethoscopes in Modern Fiction. And my starting point is a classic work in the field of sound studies. Some of you probably know this book, The Audible Past by Jonathan Stern. I want to take a look at two observations, two starting points from that book as a starting point for my own argument. He says two things. First of all, the stethoscope, he says, represents a crucial step in the history of modern sound and listening. Why, according to him, the headphones of a stethoscope, a crucial part of this invention, create what he calls a private acoustic space, isolating the hearer in a world of sound, which enables you to attend to the precise sonic features of the sound that you are hearing, an effect that was later replicated, according to Stern, in devices like telephones, radios, and so on. Second important point with regard to the stethoscope is that it allows access to the inner body of humans, obviously, sick humans, but also healthy humans, allowing the human ear to hear minute sounds, usually not audible, to humans. And of course, these minute sounds can now also be made meaningful in terms of health or illness. So first step, the stethoscope is crucial. Second point that I want to highlight here is that according to Stern, sound is by definition, he says, an anthropocentric category. Why? Because in his view, it refers inevitably to vibrations that can be heard by the human, even when talking about animal ears, he says. Ultimately, the reference point is human, so there is inevitably an anthropocentric bias. His conclusion, sound is a product of the human senses and not a thing in the world apart from humans. Now, this is an influential book, as I said. It's wrong. Because if you take a look at the work that is being done on sound in literature, for instance, in the work of John Picker, they replicate all of this material and replicate this bias. He says, for instance, if you take a look at Victorian literature, late 19th century literature, it is full, he says, of hypersensitive hearers. It is full of hidden hearts beating for those perceptive men and women who would hear them, inviting what he calls stethoscopic perception, even on the part of readers. And of course, he uses this to talk about how sound and listening encodes and is related to certain anxieties about Victorian identity, but this always remains within the anthropocentric frame of Stern. Anxieties about Victorian identity related to class, related to gender, but never this issue of human hearing, animal hearing. And this, of course, is what I want to turn to next. Because if you take a look at these, yes, okay, first of all, general point. Of course, vets use stethoscope. And we have someone in the room who knows much more about vets than I am. So, than I do, so. So here you have two ads highlighting this. The fact, of course, that vets use stethoscopes. And if you take a look at the early debates, the early writings on stethoscopes, there too you have this reflection on whether or not vets should actually use stethoscopes. And Stern doesn't talk about this at all. Laennec, for instance, the French doctor, the French inventor of the stethoscope, says that he really hasn't done a lot of work on auscultation, listening with a stethoscope on animals, but he says, I am still of opinion that it will be found very useful in cases relevant to vets. And of course, he invented the bloody thing, so it has to be useful. Because he immediately adds, well, you know, in some cases, with some species, it might actually be difficult to do. For instance, the horse, he says, if you want to listen to the respiratory, to the lungs with a stethoscope, apparently, he said, this is very difficult to do. The same ambivalent response we find in the work of William Jowatt, a British veterinary surgeon who used some of these ideas. He says, look, the stethoscope would be inconvenient for vets. He doesn't want to use it because, you know, animals, their bodies, it's difficult to. This is his argument. But at the same time, he says, well, listening to animals is actually really a good thing. This is an important lesson of the stethoscope. We should pay closer attention. We should listen to the chest and belly of various animals. For instance, in the case of the cow, if we do so, he says, we will be able to identify pregnancy much sooner. You'll hear, for instance, the beating of the heart of the calf. That will be distinctly heard. And you will also have an audible rushing of the blood through the vessels of the placenta. zooming into this animal body as if we're actually there among these organs. And so so stethoscopes have certain uses too. So, as I was saying, stethoscopic perception in literature, when people talk about this, there is always this exclusive human focus. So now I want to take a look at three novels that deal quite explicitly, on the one hand, with the human-animal boundary, and on the other hand, that deal with sound and stethoscopes. And I want to see how these two questions overlap, fail to overlap. Basically, my research question, if you will, being that if a stethoscope and the invention of the stethoscope creates new attention to sound, also in literature and in reading, what about this human-animal question? Okay. So, I'm going to be taking a look at three novels. Swift Down, which I'm sure none of you know. Dracula, which I'm sure all of you know. And Cormac McCarthy's The Crossing. But first, Swift Down. This is written by an independent writer. It's actually quite close to Vanity Publishing, with an independent publisher. But the important thing is that he's also, as the cover tells us, a long-time practicing veterinarian in Montana. And the story deals, on a general level, with a real-life flood that happened in Montana in 1964, killed a number of inhabitants of a Blackfeet reservation. And zooming in, it's also the story of a vet-turned-novelist, like the author himself, called in the book Dr. Fingers Valero. And this leads to an explicit reflection on the life of the vet, and also scenes involving quite precise technical knowledge about the stethoscope. A good starting point to reflect on this human-animal question. I'm going to start with one scene in which he's examining an injured animal. So he checked the hydration, pinching the skin over the eyelid. Fingers listened to the wispy heart and struggling lungs with his ancient black rubber stethoscope, his lit. He tightened the temporary tourniquet and deftly slipped a catheter into the four-leg vein, seemingly all in one fluid motion. Once the fluid had dripped its magic, the dog came to appreciate Dr. Valero. Mardo, the dog's owner, watched the doctor come into a rhythm with his patient and watched Fingers' constant monitoring of vital signs, his intuitive movements. Clearly, this is a very positive scene in which this human and animal come into a certain rhythm. All of this happens in a fluid motion, and this doctor has sort of intuitive movements. Now, the interesting thing is that if he's examining an animal here using a stethoscope, towards the end of the novel, he himself has to be examined, because he himself is struggling with his health, leading him first to examine himself. This is what all doctors do, right? And then he has to go to a hospital where another doctor treats him. And again, we have this stethoscope. First, he's examining himself. His heart sounded fine, lub dub, lub lub, and so on. He tried to palpate his liver under his rib cage, but couldn't get a feel of the hepatic margin under the ribs like he could a cat's. So there's an awareness of this different anatomy there, and also quite precise technical knowledge. I haven't, in fact, looked that up yet. I have no idea what a hepatic margin is. So there's this sort of professional expertise that is being evoked there. And so first he examines himself, and then later in the novel he's examined by a young, attractive female doctor, which is interesting, I'm not going to go into that. What I'm interested in here in this passage is that while being examined, he's constantly reflecting on the similarities between himself and his animal patients at this particular moment. So she massaged his neck, much like Valerone might unwind a tense horse. The she-doctor percussed his rib cage with piano fingers. She used a Lippmann stethoscope similar to the one he used to hear inside animals. She spotted the head of the stethoscope on various parts of his chest, listening carefully. Fingers came fully awake. Perhaps, he said something differently earlier, human medicine is not so different from veterinary medicine. So, we have clearly a close attention to the precise sonic features of this heart. Right, that's love, don't go. We also get a sort of access to the inner body of these animal patients, hearing their liver, hearing their heart, their lungs, and so on. And clearly, the text, the novel, tries to establish a link between humans and animals, human and animal medicine, human and animal patients. The crucial issue for the novel being a sort of proper husbandry model in which proper diet, exercise, etc. leads to well-being. Now, there are two remarkable things that I'd like to highlight here. First, the novel stresses these different anatomies of different creatures, as I mentioned, this hepatic margin issue, which is different in the cat. At the same time, though, you really get the impression that the novel wants to stress the essential humanity of all creatures. Ultimately, humans and animals share a sort of human nature, which enables the person narrating the story to immediately access the dog's mind. The dog came to appreciate Dr. Valerot, as if all of a sudden we granted access to this essentially human mind. So it doesn't take the difference between humans and animals very seriously, perhaps. Secondly, the vet is very critical of modern medicine and modern vets. It doesn't want to use ultrasounds, doesn't want to use x-rays, his nickname, Fingers. He wants to do it with his fingers. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that the stethoscope is exempt from this critique of modern medicine. Somehow, the stethoscope isn't seen as something modern, as a technology, as a medium at all, as if somehow it's a transparent interface providing direct access to this inner animal body. Okay, first case study, Mad Dracula, monitoring the species boundary. I don't have to explain the plot in great detail, I think. It's not a very complex plot either. What basically happens is that this evil count obviously invades England, attacks the young, attractive women, and tries to suck their blood. So all the men rally, follow the count back to Transylvania, and ultimately end up killing him. Now, in the existing literature on this book, there are two main strands, one of them stressing monsters, the other stressing media. First set of critics basically says that this is a story about the production of otherness, of monstrosity, highlighting features of Dracula's appearance that can be linked to horrible stereotypes about women, about Jews, about all sorts of other Orient and so on. So these critics, you could say, stress the supposedly negative dimension of the fictional world. Another set of critics stress the more positive, the forces of good. In their view, the story is really about the counterattack of a democratic empire with the help of modern medicine and modern technical media. In fact, this is what Friedrich Kittler says in a relatively famous interpretation of the book. He says, it's not a novel about vampires, it's a novel about bureaucracy, which means that it's still a horror story. So you have two strands. Yet interestingly, even though Dracula is consistently associated with all sorts of animals, not just wolves and bats, but also lizards, all sorts of... The animal dimension of the book has actually received relatively little attention from critics, as Mario Ortiz Robles has pointed out. And when media scholars talk about the book, they mainly focus on the phonograph. And with good reason, because the phonograph really is important in the book. At a certain point, Nina, the central female character, listens to the notes a doctor made on a phonograph. This is one of those passages. He placed me, Nina, in a comfortable chair and arranged the phonograph so that I could touch it without getting up. Then he very thoughtfully took a chair with his back to me so that I might be as free as possible. I put the forked metal to my ears and listened. So again, he turns aside this private acoustic space. She has to attend closely to these sounds. Now, the phonograph is important, as I said, but there's also another medium that is entirely undiscussed in the secondary literature, and this is, of course, a stethoscope. And my argument will be that this stethoscope is actually perhaps more important because it proves to be a crucial tool in fighting this evil threat. As I said, Dracula is sucking the blood of these young, attractive women in the middle of the night, and at first they don't really, the good characters don't really realize this. And Dr. Van Helsing, the good doctor from the Netherlands, he brings a stethoscope and he listens to her heart. This is Lucy's heart beat a trifle more audibly to the stethoscope, and her lungs had a perceptible movement. And this is a good thing because this proves that she is still human. As long as she has a heartbeat, as long as she keeps breathing, she is human. Because of course, when Jonathan Harker first encounters Dracula in the coffin, he's unable to identify this being as either being dead or alive, because there was no pulse, no breath, no beating of the heart. So as long as you're able to have a heartbeat and breath, you're still alive, and the stethoscope allows you to monitor this. Right? So monitor the species boundary via the stethoscope. Attentive listening is important. And of course, you could say that basically, because you have a heartbeat, this proves that you're still a natural creature, not an evil being of the night, which actually puts you quite close to good animals. And in that sense, it could develop this animal connection. But the novel actually doesn't want to do that. It pays much more attention to the difference between good humans and bad, evil animals, which are likened to Dracula. So what actually happens in many of the scenes following this infection, this attack on these women, is an attempt to monitor the infected characters. When are they human, and when do they stop being so? For instance, another description of Lucy breathing in the middle of the night. For a little bit, her breast heaved softly, and her breath came and went like a tired child's. And then there came the strange change which I had noticed in the night. Her breathing grew stertorous, the mouth opened, and the teeth looked longer than ever. So she's on the cusp, right? One moment she's still breathing like a tired child's, the other moment she's basically turning into a vampire. So you need to listen closely to attend to this moment. Now, when another scene in which a character's breathing is monitored closely, when you read this, this somehow seems to affect the heart rate of one of the characters in the room as well, a doctor. The poor man's breathing came in uncertain gasps. This suspense grew and grew upon me. I could almost hear the beating of my own heart, and the blood surging through my temples sounded like blows from a hammer. And in fact, you could link this to research on the sensation novel, which basically says that a certain genre of literature wants to keep representing this excited moment to increase the heart rate of the reader himself or herself. And in fact, in this early work, people interpret this as a feminization of the reader because these nervous states were associated with women. But what I'd like to suggest is that you could see this as an animalization of these people too, emphasizing this animal dimension of their bodies. And in fact, you could develop this and take a look at movies as well, in which you often have movie soundtracks that use heartbeats under them for a similar effect, right? But I don't have time to go into that here. I'd now like to move on to my final case study, Cormac McCarthy's The Crossing, middle of the 90s. Story of a young cowboy, a very young cowboy, Billy, who ends up crossing and recrossing the US-Mexico border in the first half of the 20th century. There are basically two main storylines, two sections in the novel. One is he traps a pregnant wolf, supposed to kill her or take her back to his father, but all of a sudden he decides to drop everything and to escort her back home, whatever home may be, in Mexico. Later in the novel, he is forced to return to Mexico with his young brother, Boyd, to find horses that were stolen in a raid on their home that killed their mother and father. We are in a Cormac McCarthy novel. Much as in Game of Thrones, everyone dies. Yeah, horrible. In any case, so you have these two storylines, and both the she-wolf, and this young brother, Boyd. In both of these cases, Billy is explicitly described as their custodian, who has to take care of them. And he keeps emphasizing this again and again and again. But what turns out to be the case, this being a Cormac McCarthy novel, is that the world turns out to be a very hostile place. At a certain point, they are forced to give first aid, and of course, a farmer doesn't want to do that at all, giving first aid to a damn wolf. Wolves do not belong in the realm of medicine. Right? This is sort of the suggestion. And there have been a couple of readings recently that are relevant to my claim here, both of them suggesting that basically in McCarthy, you get an evocation of something that moves beyond the human point of view through moments of animal agency. Yet Malevitz doesn't really discuss the animality of the human characters in the book, or through evoking this indifferent or even malignant evil landscape. Yet Marshall, this is her interpretation, doesn't discuss the interior of bodies. She's mainly looking at the exterior and that landscape, and I think we need to take a closer look at bodies as well. So let me develop this briefly. At a certain point, Boyd is shot, and he has this life-threatening wound, and again we have a doctor in a stethoscope. Boyd breathed, but his breathing was shallow and labored. The doctor lifted the earpieces of the stethoscope into place and listened with his eyes closed. In the panes of the doctor's eyeglasses, the thin flame of the votive lamp stood centered, like the light of holy inquiry burning in his aging eyes. The poultice, they take this bandage away, it came away unwillingly, like something that had been feeding. As though this is somehow alive, right? As though we're still in sort of horror-like mode. So it's likened to a religious ritual, this medical examination, and the world turns out to be malignant even in the realm of the body. So basically what you find in a number of other scenes throughout the novel is an emphasis on the shared vulnerability of embodied creatures by emphasizing this heart rate and this breathing. You find this when Billy first encounters the wolf, for instance. His heart was slamming inside his chest like something that wanted out. Again, so the organ is alive. But the wolf has a very similar response. When they encounter very dangerous humans, he could feel the wolf trembling electrically against him and her heart hammering. Once again, we often enter this sort of moment when we see inside the body of these animals and actually see their organs. Another novel of the Border Trilogy, this is three novels of which A Crossing is the middle, while inside the vaulting of the ribs between his knees, the darkly meated heart pumped, and the blood pulsed and the bowels shifted in their massive convolutions. And this is in fact a sort of inside the body perspective, which returns in The Crossing when the wolf is killed. And the little wolves in her belly felt a cold draw all about them, and they cried out mutely in the dark, and he buried them all and piled the rocks over them. Okay, so in conclusion, I've highlighted three sets of scenes involving stethoscopes, all of which draw attention to sound, listening, and the inner body. Not just a matter of stethoscopic perception, but actually sort of stethoscopic point of view inside the body. Three ways of thinking about the animal-human boundary, all of which stress the shared vulnerability, the shared embodied character of humans and animals, but very different models of thinking about human-animal relations in terms of proper husbandry, anxious monitoring, and indifferent materiality. But even in this very pessimistic world of McCarthy, all of these books reveal a very strong trust in medicine. The Fingers Valerone, Van Helsing and Dracula, and the Doctor in McCarthy seem to suggest that this is sort of like a transparent interface, providing direct access to the inner body. And in certain scenes, this emphasis on the heart rate and on the breath, you could argue, perhaps leads to something like an animalization of the reader's body too. So, brief summary, stethoscopic perception involves animals too, in contrast to what people in sound studies say. And when we look at animal sounds, we shouldn't just take a look at these organic vocalizations, in my view, but perhaps also attend to these sounds of the body, which were not audible before stethoscopes.
Thank you very much. Time for some questions about the animal sounds. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed the paper. I'm just kind of intrigued that you've kind of really interestingly kind of inverted where Stern's argument usually leads, which is to suggest that the kind of mechanization of medicine through sort of listening through technology, the stethoscope being sort of leads to a situation in which the patient becomes mute, like the human patient becomes mute, and they what they have to say is unimportant, and it's only what can be found out from what you can hear is the important thing. And so it's a kind of interesting subversion to say that, of course, I hadn't considered before that what it means is that you are losing the sort of animal or the organic aspect of the, you're making it scientific, but it's intriguing in this context to think about how I've normally seen that argument presented when people are following Stern, is to say, well, the problem with that is it means that patients don't get to speak, they don't get to be their own witness, as it were. But of course, in the context of here, the notion of actually revaluing not being able to speak is the important thing, if I've understood that right.
Sure, it's true. It's basically, my wife is a doctor, and she would probably agree. Stern says patients lie, so you need a stethoscope. They'll shut up, and then you can hear what's actually happening. Now, the interesting thing is, though, it's true, and I'm glad to hear that you like that I'm taking this in a slightly different direction, but you could also say that maybe what I'm saying about this transparent interface is close to what Stern is saying, too. That basically, if you listen with a stethoscope, you have the real. It's direct access to the facts. In fact, you're inside the body. It's almost like this visual that ended the previous presentation, right? It takes you inside the body. So in that sense, maybe there's also, here as well, a belief that this takes us closer to the actual medical facts.
But when does it stop becoming facts? So that if you think of other things that use sound to make pictures, for example, is it only because it's between the ear? How thin does that layer? There's a sort of fetishization in your first example around the kind of stethoscope, for example, that's being used.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of wondering what that does. When does it stop being? I'm immediately suspicious as soon as we think anything that is transmitted through anything else is actually the facts, because it.
But this is what I was trying to suggest. I fully agree, but they're totally unaware of this. There is no explicit reflection on, the Lidman, the name, right? He wants to show that he's a doctor and he knows what it's called, right? But there is no actual reflection on what type of stethoscope, whether or not it's functioning or malfunctioning, whether there is all this background noise and it's still difficult to hear even with the headphones. No reflection on that at all. Precisely because there's this sort of idea that these are the facts themselves.
Can I just come in? I mean, all vets diagnose without speech from the patient as such. and we do it quite well. I'm making your point that in fact animals don't lie. The owners sometimes lie on their teeth, but you get to know that. But I mean, but in fact, veterinary diagnosis is massively based upon auscultation, percussion, and palpation, and those are feeling, and they're all sense, they're the special senses, none of which actually involve speech as a communication, and they're still massively important. And the new uses of ultrasound and things like that, they're just more elaborate versions of the same thing, but it's also auscultation, palpation, percussion. And auscultation, and that of which the most important is auscultation, is the sense, I think, really, which is about terrific.
No, and I guess this is, you know, this is part of a larger project where I want to analyze the cultural meanings of animal sounds, and I've done some work on vocalizations, and I felt that it was important to attend to these other types of sounds as well, which I think literature tries to do something with as well.
Erica,
I'm really interested in the fact that you're suggesting that the invention of the stethoscope changed the way literature represented, or had the potential to represent, a sense of interiority. So rather than it being a Hamlet to be or not to be, it's actually, as Karen was, you know, pressing on this idea that there's a kind of almost passivity to the interior that we're getting at. And what, it might be an unfair question because I'm asking you to tell me something about something before you've talked about here, but what models of interiority precede the stethoscope?
This is actually quite an interesting question, which leads in many different directions. One of the other things that I should have taken a look at, and not haven't taken a look at yet, but will do soon, is Frankenstein, for instance. An argument has been made that basically what you find in Frankenstein is not the model of the animal and the animal creation, but basically a reconfiguration of different human parts. Mm. So that would complicate the argument, but I would be interested to see how basically representations of heartbeats and sounds of the human body, how they may have changed because of this. Of course, Picker's argument, when it comes to more social sounds, let's say, is that really it has changed because of the stethoscope and because of all these other media. It will be a more difficult argument to make that for the human body as such, but I would argue and would assume, would hypothesize, that it does create closer attention to these sounds. Maybe there have been sounds like these before in literature, but maybe not with such detail. This would be my hypothesis, at least.
Because the alternative reading to that, I'm sure you're right, but I think the alternative reading might be that, and I'm going back to the 17th century, people would have listened very closely, because they would have known that, you know, breath being drawn in a difficult